From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's going on behind the scenes in some internal leadership disputes at United Auto Workers?
There certainly has been expressions of disappointment and frustration by workers regarding findings from these reports that the Monitor has reported.
Also, novelist and filmmaker John Sayles talks about writing Detroit history in his new book about the auto industry in the early 20th century.
So I'm always interested in people who are just caught up in the flood of these big forces coming together.
And we'll get a recap of last night's debate between leading Democrats running for U.S. Senate.
In the very first question, just about making life more affordable, Elsaya brought up AIPAC and corporate donations and corporate money. And so this was a fight that started very early on.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we're going to recap for you the Michigan Democratic debate for U.S. Senate. Last night, Abdul Al-Sayed and Haley Stevens went head-to-head.
Much of the debate, you know, both these candidates came out swinging, and they both immediately settled into their lanes.
We'll speak with the correspondent who covered it, but first, trouble within the United Auto Workers continues. For several years now, Sean Fain, the union's president, has been the face of a resurgent UAW. Styled as the man who took on Detroit's automakers and won. Now there's a fight closer to home. Court filings recently unsealed describe a tense back and forth between Fain and the man appointed to watch over the union, attorney Neil Barofsky. At the center of it was one tense exchange from a couple of years ago and a question of whether Fain was leaning on people below him to secure benefits for his fiancée. To help us understand more about what's at stake for Fain and for the rank-and-file workers watching all this unfold, we're joined by Brianna Noble, auto and business reporter at the Detroit News. Brianna, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, April.
Let's review. There's some people who may have not been keeping as close a tabs on what's going on with the UAW. Why is there a court-appointed monitor sort of interacting with and observing the union's business these days?
Yes, the court-appointed monitor was established back in 2021. This happened following a years-long corruption investigation into the union that resulted in multiple UAW officials, as well as a few automotive executives being prosecuted and convicted as a result of that investigation. The monitor was put in place in order to help the union rid itself of policies and practices and implement better safeguards for the union moving forward.
And can you maybe tell us a word or two about Neil Barofsky, who is the court-appointed monitor who's been serving in this role?
Neil Barofsky is an attorney with the Chicago-based law firm, Jenner & Block. He was instituted as the UAW monitor back in 2021. He previously served as the special inspector general for the $700 billion troubled asset relief program, which was a series of moves created during the Great Recession to stabilize and strengthen the financial sector. He also currently serves as the independent ombudsperson over Credit Suisse's investigation into its historical Nazi ties, as well as the government-appointed co-monitor of the New York City Housing Authority.
The TARP program, there's a term I haven't heard in a hot minute. So this is someone who has a little professional experience with the auto industry and knows the players. How would you say the working relationship has looked between the court-appointed monitor and the union during Sean Fain's time as UAW president?
Yes. So the UAW, under one of its previous presidents, selected Neil Barofsky as the monitor. However, under UAW President Sean Fain, you kind of describe the situation as a bit tense, and that had previously shown up in court records and hearings regarding the efforts by Barofsky to obtain documentation related to his investigations into individuals like UAW President Sean Fain. There had been some shifts in terms of department and board management within the union, including the removal of Secretary Treasurer Margaret Mock from her leadership roles and overseeing, as well as the removal of Vice President Rich Boyer from the Stellantis department. And as a result of those decisions, those individuals requested investigations by the monitor.
That brings us right up to speed with the latest filing that you and your colleague unearthed for this. So this is a discussion dating back to February 2024. What we're about to discuss happened a year and a half ago, more or less. Can you explain what the tone of the conversation was between Sean Fain and Neil Barofsky, and what they were talking about when they had this exchange?
Yes. So back in December 2023, the International Executive Board that sort of governs the union passed a statement that called for a ceasefire with respect to the Israel-Hamas war. And as a result of that, the monitor who oversees a hotline for UAW members and other entities who might want to reach out to the monitor over a number of things, did receive some feedback from members and other organizations regarding the results of that statement. So according to the conversation between UAW President Sean Fain and the monitor Neil Barofsky, there was a phone call that happened following the ceasefire statement in which Barofsky, who at the time in his role with Credit Suisse, investigating historical Nazi ties, had brought up the fact that he had a tie to sort of an expert on anti-Semitism and offered to sort of make a connection between the IEB and this individual with Credit Suisse regarding that conversation.
So in this conversation, Barofsky is saying, hey, if you want to talk to somebody about the implications about this, I know a guy, right? Was that sort of the tone of it?
Yes.
Yeah. And so Sean Fain responded in, I'm not going to ask you to reproduce this because it's language that we can't really use on a family public radio program. And anyone who's ever seen Sean Fain speak in person knows that he's not shy about swearing. He basically said, for anybody to ever blank say, I'm anti-Semitic, brother, I'll fight your blank in front of this building in a heartbeat. And that was just one of the comments. Barofsky, am I reading this right, that Barofsky denied that he suggested Sean Fain is anti-Semitic?
Yes, there were definitely moments of quite a bit of tension at times as they were sort of rehashing what each of their perspectives on how that phone call had gone. And as a result of that, also a separate email that the monitor had forwarded from the ADL regarding a ceasefire statement made by a local union, and how that email had been forwarded to the entirety of the International Executive Board.
So, Brianna, on paper, the whole of this exchange looks like the two of them talking about this statement that the union approved and put out into the world. And Barofsky, you know, maybe suggesting that maybe some context would be helpful, and Fain blows up at him in a pretty spectacular way. What does this mean in terms of what it tells us about the relationship between the union's elected president, who is up for re-election this year, and this court-appointed official?
Now, in terms of what the monitor says regarding his action in the meeting, he says that his reaching out was with respect to helping to provide further information because he had this resource available to help make that connection for the IEB. The response by UAW's counsel, as well as UAW President Sean Fain, is that because of the position that the monitor is in terms of overseeing the union, that it was an overstep of power. And this really kind of comes into the works today because the monitor in his most recent filing report has suggested he's having further conversations with the parties of the consent decree, which includes the UAW as well as the Justice Department. In his most recent investigations, he's described pattern of retaliation individuals within the president's office has made with respect to some of the top leaders. And there's still conversations ongoing between the UAW Justice Department and the monitor and the court regarding the findings of the investigation and the what should be the outcome of that.
I wanted to just pull back up for a minute and ask what your sense of the temperature is on the ground about this. Like I mentioned, there's going to be a union election this fall, I believe in November, right? And this is Sean Fain's chance to get reelected. He is someone who was elected on a platform of bringing a new energy and some new methods to the union. How would you say Fain is viewed as a leader at this point, given this and everything else that's been going on with the union? I mean, it's been an incredibly tumultuous couple of years in the industry with all kinds of new tariffs and new federal policies coming into play.
Yes, there's been a lot of activity within the union since the UAW President Sean Fain took over back in 2023, sort of right away. He kind of had a trial by fire in terms of straight going into the negotiations with the Detroit 3 automakers. We had the stand-up strike that fall that resulted in record contracts for the workers of those companies. And those are some major historic victories for the union that certainly gave it a lot of momentum. And we have seen UAW membership over the past few years grow. However, there certainly has been expressions of disappointment and frustration regarding the findings from these reports that the monitor has reported. You know, they feel like they have dealt with these years-long corruptions. And while the actions described under the current administration may not rise to the level of criminal activity that was previously found in the top ranks of the union, there's this feeling that they just want to leave that portrayal and poor reputation in the past and move forward, especially given that Fain and the others that he ran with, ran on this agenda of transparency, of reform.
Brianna, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brianna Noble, auto and business reporter at the Detroit News. You can read her coverage at DetroitNews.com. It's time for a break now. When we get back, writer John Sayles talks about his new novel, Crucible, a rich imagining of Detroit in the 1920s and 30s.
I always say the nice thing about writing a historical novel is somebody's written your plot for you.
Our conversation's coming up in just a moment. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In the new novel Crucible, writer and filmmaker John Sayles brings his seasoned eye for history, power politics, and the American labor movement to a multifaceted story about jazz-age Detroit. He invites us on a journey through many corners of Henry Ford's empire, from workers of all kinds who streamed into the city to work the line, to journalists who were writing the first draft of Detroit history in real time, and to Ford's own inner circle, as the city's most famous industrialist aimed for a more and more ambitious influence over American life. The book has already won rave reviews for Sayles' dynamic and cinematic eye for the early 20th century. He joins us now to talk more about Crucible. John Sayles, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be talking to people in that area.
You've spent a lot of years writing and creating stories about how work and labor organizing has shaped our lives. I guess it was kind of inevitable that these roads would lead back around to Detroit at some point. Is there anything you would want people to know about why this story seemed important to you?
Yeah, for two reasons. I grew up in the 50s, and in the 50s, my image of Detroit from the East Coast was of a major city. It had a football team and a baseball team and a basketball team. It was where all the cars were made. When I grew up, you didn't see a foreign car on the streets. With the UAW, it was one of the centers of union power in the United States back when, so many more Americans were members of union. And by 1967, 68, when I was graduating from high school, that had really started to fall apart. And the same thing kind of happened to the city I'm from, Schenectady, New York, which is where the General Electric Company originally was. It was the combination of the jobs leaving and then racial tension that I think was kind of like, well, this is such an iconic American city. And to me, this is the front lines. You know, a crucible is, among other things, you know, besides something that you, in a chemistry lab, you put different ingredients in and heat them up. It's a place where things meet and reactions happen, and not always positive ones.
The way you write about Henry Ford, you really don't pull punches about, you know, his anti-Semitism and everything that he sort of let loose in the world because of the things that he believed. You are upfront about how hard he was, what a hard man, even on people that he loved very much, like his son Edsel. And you also give us that again, that sense of his, like the scope of his thinking. There's one point where he's thinking about whether he should start this plant, you know, this basically plantation in Brazil to make rubber. And he's thinking, if you need wood, why not cut down and mail your own trees? And what is glass but sand and heat? Why not make your own? What is steel but iron or crushed, heated with coke fire, with the impurities skimmed off? I mean, it's just like this beautiful, this almost beautiful thought. How did you come to imagine that side of him in addition to the darker pieces of his personality?
Well, he's not somebody who just lucked into a fortune. I mean, you know, he's not William Randolph Hearst, whose father, you know, owned a mine that, you know, suddenly paid off. He's somebody who was a great tinkerer. He was a good gearhead. You know, when it looked like this was the next thing that should happen, he figured out the V8 engine, and he was a visionary in some ways. He was also extremely ignorant, and ignorant is different than stupid. He was a man of his time. You know, this is a time when even Catholics were hugely prejudiced against. And, you know, he was this farm kid, you know, who really hadn't met that many people who weren't like him. So there was just a lot of stuff that he didn't know. And I think, you know, it's an interesting thing that when I started this book, Elon Musk was just a guy who made cars, you know, and he hadn't taken that second step to announcing to the world, oh, I know how you all shall live, you know, and I got a bunch of ideas, and just give me a little power and I'll show you and I'll work everything out. And that happened to Henry Ford. It happens to an awful lot of people who have that kind of success where everything they touch turns into gold. He really thought that he was really just something, he'd been touched by something bigger than human. Actually, whatever his personal feelings were, he was the only manufacturer in the United States who was hiring African Americans and paying the same as his white workers. So he's a very mixed bag. So he's not just a villain, you know, he is a protagonist in a way, because at that time in Detroit, you couldn't avoid him. Even the middle of the road and slightly progressive newspapers, if you wrote a story critical to him and his company, it might not get printed.
There is so much in the book, to your point about the opportunities that Ford offered for Black workers who were coming north. There is so much in the book that sort of conflates the story that we are told about opportunity during the Great Migration, understanding more about how people were actually living and what was expected of them when they came north to, you know, to take advantage of that $5 a day opportunity. In the book, you invite us into the Battle of the Overpass, this moment when the company is having, you know, is having labor problems, and these Black workers are expected to defend to defend Ford. this is a storied moment in American labor. What did you imagine of that night, and what did you learn about it as you were getting into the writing?
Well, it's, you know, if you read the stuff that's just about unions and very pro union, this is this shining moment, you know, this kind of sacrifice that, you know, where some of the main people within that union put themselves on the line. I don't think they went there thinking. They may have thought they would have gotten arrested. I don't think they thought they were going to be beaten badly and thrown downstairs or even off the overpass. But I'm always interested in the complexity of these things, that this is a very new union. The UAW has just broken away from the AFL and, you know, made this new confederation, the CIO. There are, you know, radicals and moderates within the union. You know, there are a lot of jealousies within it. And they've had to be so, have to use so much subterfuge to get anybody to talk about the possibility of a union within that factory. I mean, the service department that Harry Bennett ran for Ford, if you went to the bathroom, not only did the foreman have a stopwatch to time how long it took you to get there and get back, when you got in there into the men's room, there were no doors on the toilet stalls. And there was a, you know, a company thug standing across watching you as you did your business, just so you understood, don't think you're going to be able to talk to somebody in the bathroom or in the next stall while you're there.
For context, Harry Bennett was Henry Ford's security director and ended up having a much bigger operational role.
Yeah, he was a bit of a, basically, Henry Ford saw him in a fist fight with two sailors and said, that's a gutsy little guy. And he hired him, and then he just kept upping him and upping him and upping him until he was head of security, which became of a goon squad eventually.
Yeah. Harry Bennett is one of many, many Michigan people who turn up in this story. There's a young woman named Rosa who's kind of figuring out her place in working people's politics at the time when the factories are going full steam. There's a lumberjack from the UP who ends up for a short time running Ford's plantation in Brazil, and his life just goes completely in a direction that he never expected. Diego Rivera pops up in the book for lunch with Henry Ford. Ensembles have always been a great power and a great strength of the stories that you've created for us. Can I ask you if there's anything you find challenging about writing them?
You know, it's just part of the work, which is you look at the time period. You know, I always say the nice thing about writing a historical novel is somebody's written your plot for you. You know, I'm not making up events. I have a timeline that I've been provided and a bunch of, you know, high points or low points, depending on what it is that's happening. And I kind of start and say, well, I want to touch base with there. And then as I start to think about the characters, who's going to populate this world, you start to think, well, who among these characters might be there? Who would have to be there? You know, who would be affected by it, even if they weren't there? And so you start kind of knitting these things together. So you hope by about 50 to 100 pages into the book, the next time somebody shows up, people remember, oh, yeah, that's the Polish guy who works on the assembly.
That's Kaz, right.
Yeah, or that's the daughter of the guy who got sent to Brazil, and she's thrilled because she's leaving the UP and she might get a monkey. So, you know, it's just an expanding universe. And then really what you have to do is, you know, I overwrite these books. So, you know, there's a lot about a lot of characters. And then you try to shape the thing. So there is, you know, there is some form to it. There's some arc to it and some arc to those characters' experience within it. And that means that you're cutting things, whatever. But also you're, you know, what journalists call laying pipe and screenwriters call it, which is, oh, if this person's going to come to this realization or whatever, or this political move or whatever, I've got to prepare the reader for it. And we'll see whether, oh, that's very unlikely, or, oh, she was headed in that direction from the get-go.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with writer and filmmaker John Sayles. He has a new historical novel this year called Crucible, set in Detroit in the 1920s and 30s. As I mentioned, you had journalism experiences early in your writing career, and I know that a lot of the research for this book had to have come from the newspaper accounts of the time. Is there anything that you could share about what you observed of the writers of those years and how they were telling the stories of the city?
Well, there's two things going on there. One is, if you watch the popular media of the time about journalists, reporters are, it's kind of like the front page. They are cynical. You know, they've seen it all. And they know that, okay, well, whatever I may feel, that's not necessarily what my paper wants out in the world. So some of what I learn, I may share it with a colleague whose editor is a little more open-minded about those things. So there was kind of a camaraderie at the same time that there was competition between those guys. So I was reading the Hearst paper in Detroit, and two or three of them, the black newspaper was harder to track down. But what's interesting is you take an event, then you go online to the newspapers on the next day, which is when the story would break, and you see how the different newspapers, how much ink they give it, what the editorials say, those kinds of things. And you kind of start to get a feeling for, oh, this is a paper that is not totally in the pocket of Henry Ford. And this is a paper that is, even if he's not paying them, just because that's their worldview. You get this nice thing of, oh, what else happened on that day? What was playing in the movie theaters? You know, what was there a show happening? Was it freezing cold? Was it really hot? You know, there's a bunch of marches, you know, in this thing, and I want to know the weather. Having been to those marches, the weather makes a big difference in what your experience was.
No question.
I know that the thing about the police being pissed off that, you know, some of these marches were on bitter, bitter cold days. You know, it's like, come on, guys, just get it over and let us all go home.
The details really pay off at many points in the story, just down to the sun-kissed chorus girls at the Fox Theater before the main show. It was
eye-opening. There's a very good Jimmy Cagney movie where he's like the producer of those shows that used to be a big deal before movies, when people would pay their money and they'd expect to see a live show and then one or two movies on top of it. And those shows went from big city to big city. And they were huge employers. You know, they're kind of like a road show of a hit musical now, employed a lot of people. And if you've ever been in the old Fox Theater, it was a major palace. I mean, it was just if you came from, you know, outside the city and you went in there, it was worth the admission just to look at the place.
Over the arc of the novel, the mayor in the first part of the book, the mayor of Detroit is a man named Charles Bowles, who history buffs might recognize. He was a very crooked guy. He was supported by the Ku Klux Klan. And he's so crooked that one character, the radio personality Jerry Buckley, is thinking to himself, the guy never even made a pretense of being straight once he was in. When I read that line, I felt, in a strange way, a little heartened that our country has been wrestling with corruption and power for a pretty long time. And then I just felt extremely sad for the exact same reason.
Yeah, well, Gary Buckley, you know, came to an unfortunate end because he thought he was, you know, doing what he should do and commenting on what was going on in his city. Detroit, because of its position, you know, right across the river was Canada, where during Prohibition, the good stuff came, you know, the bottled and bonded stuff came, not the bathtub stuff. You know, so it was a major, staging area for all mob activity. So it had as lively a gangster, you know, epic and era as Chicago did. And there were various reactions to that. You know, Chicago for a while, the mayors were in on it and you know, were very, very corrupt. And everybody just kind of thought, because they really didn't want to not be able to drink, they just said, well, big deal, you know, so he's making a little money on it. What's interesting, though, is that, you know, this is a guy who is recalled, which had never happened in a major city before. And the next mayor is this guy, Murphy, who is the, you know, somebody who, you know, was known as an incorruptible and non-racist judge who ends up on the Supreme Court eventually. You know, so this is, you know, you can't characterize a city by its politicians. You just realize it's a free for all. And, you know, sometimes the people win and sometimes they don't.
John Sayles, thank you so, so very much for talking with us. The new novel, of course, is Crucible. And if folks happen to be in Ann Arbor, there's a whole archive of documents associated with your films and your other work over the years. It's such a pleasure to get to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Ava.
Let's take a little break here. When we get back, we'll recap the first debate between two Democratic hopefuls for a U.S. Senate seat.
Much of the debate, you know, both these candidates came out swinging and they both immediately settled into their lanes.
That's in just a moment. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've talked already this week about the importance of Michigan's U.S. Senate election. Last night, leading contenders in the Democratic primary, Haley Stevens and Abdul Al-Sayed, met up in a televised debate that might be a lot of Michiganders' first look at how these candidates stack up against each other. Colin Jackson covered the debate for Michigan's public radio stations, and he joins us now. Hey, Colin.
Hey, April.
Representative Stevens has been in Congress for several terms now. She has some experience working in the Obama administration, you know, some years ago. It seemed like she was trying to draw a contrast by branding herself as the workhorse candidate who gets things done. What kinds of things did she mention as her examples of being effective in Congress?
One thing when we asked her afterward was she had talked about trying to get the CHIPS and Science Act through the finish line under the Biden administration. That was something she said she was most proud of during her time in Congress. She had also talked about several bills she has introduced this term dealing with things like AI or restoring the Social Security Administration employee staffing to what its levels were pre-DOGE. She had talked about just different funding bills she had sponsored during her first term in Congress regarding STEM research for Michigan schools. She really tried to pitch herself as the policy wonk in this debate, and somebody who, again, like you said, is the workhorse. It's something she came back to time and time again. She also came time and time again back to this idea that she has the receipts of her time in Washington to prove her effectiveness.
While Haley Stevens was repeating her work on the auto bailouts during the Great Recession, Abdul Al-Sayed is the candidate that got the United Auto Workers endorsement for the Democratic primary. And he was talking about it again last night. I want to just play a little bit about what he had to say about that. Let's listen.
I'm proud to have been endorsed by the UAW. And the reason that they've endorsed me is because they understand that I am a fighter for working people. I can tell you that there is bipartisan support already to blow up the USMCA, which has been a cancer on our manufacturing industry in Michigan and the industrial Midwest in general. That is a bill, of course, that my colleague actually voted for. And I think there's bipartisan consensus that that has been a danger. We have an opportunity to rethink trade policy to make sure that we're protecting good union jobs in this state and in this country. And I think that means rethinking how we do tariffs.
So that's Abdul Al-Sayed. How did Haley Stevens counter that, selling her record on manufacturing issues and her fluency on that?
You know, this has been, again, a key part of, a core part of her political brand from the beginning. She has always pitched herself as a manufacturing geek, her words, from Michigan. To that response, you know, she had talked about how NAFTA, she thought, was, I believe, the words she used was a, quote, crap deal that hurt a lot of Michiganders. She also talked about her legislation that would keep Chinese cars out of the American market. Just there's been a lot of concerns about whether or not the U.S. automakers would be able to keep up with that. She talked about, you know, standing up to the Trump administration, trying to get the Gordie Howe Bridge open, strengthening our relationship with some of our trade partners. And again, multiple times she came up to this idea of taking on China as an adversary and making sure that American manufacturing is protected and safe in the eyes of what she saw as a threat from China.
Yeah. Abdul Al-Sayed, I heard him talking about corporate money as a defining factor in the race. Let's play another clip of what he had to say about it.
Now, here's the thing about it. There is no left or right. Most people out there aren't asking, where do I fit on the left-right spectrum? They're asking, can I afford my groceries when I go grocery shopping? What's going to happen if I get sick or my kid gets sick? Why does my kid's school look the same way it did 30 years ago when I went there? And the answer to that question is that for too long, politicians on both sides of the aisle have taken the same corporate corrupting money. I'm the only candidate on this stage, frankly, the only candidate running for U.S. Senate, who's never taken a dime of that money.
Colin, you've covered several elections in Michigan. I mean, do you feel like that's a theme that you've seen resonate with voters in the past?
I think it's a theme that we're seeing increasingly resonate with voters. It's something that McMahon, while she was in the race, she also really tried to push, you know. I think it's interesting that you saw two candidates both claiming to be the only one who has never taken corporate money. But that aside, it's a theme that I think a lot of voters, not just in Michigan, across the country, are looking for. That's a point Al-Sayed made to me while we were speaking afterward, after the debate. It's also interesting that a lot of the conversations when he brought up corporate money, he also brought up AIPAC money, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which has been funneling money to different groups in support of Stevens. You may have seen some of the ads going out with different from different organizations that have benefited from AIPAC money. And so Al-Sayed really did his best to try to paint Stevens as this establishment candidate backed by big money interests and backed by interests who may not necessarily be fighting for the common people of Michigan.
Yeah. We have two candidates here, one of whom has served several terms in Congress and has done different kind of government administrative work, and one of whom has been a city and county public health director. Can you tell us a little bit about whether Haley Stevens made any jabs at Al-Sayed for his relative experience in office?
Oh, I mean, yes, absolutely. Much of the debate, you know, both of these candidates came out swinging and they both immediately settled into their lanes, right? We've talked about how Al-Sayed came in saying he's the outsider candidate. He's not going to be bought off by big money. Stevens immediately came out swinging, saying she's the one that has a lot of time in Congress experience. She's the policy wonk that's got her head down, that's got things done. She's a workhorse, not a show horse. At various points, she insinuated that Al-Sayed would prefer to be a celebrity senator, I believe were her words, rather than a workhorse from Michigan. She criticized him for having a podcast, for, you know, having an agent that books speaking engagements, etc. And she accused him of being coy with his finances in terms of not releasing his full tax returns yet. So those are different ways where Stevens came out swinging against Al-Sayed.
Mm-hmm. In other recent Democratic primaries, Colin, sometimes, things came down to who voters perceived as a better fighter, you know, the primaries being the place where you choose candidates that are going to go up against the other party in the general election. And Stevens was leaning into her legislative experience. Let's hear a little bit of her talking about that.
Who is going to be the workhorse? Look, I've got the receipts. I have passed big pieces of legislation. I passed my first bill to secure STEM grants for our K-12 schools in my first year in Congress. I am ready to hit the ground for our schools, for our educators, and to stand up to the corruption and the abuse of power that we see coming down from Donald Trump. If you want to stop Trump, I'm your gal.
So, Colin, what kinds of things did Abdul Al-Sayed say about Haley Stevens' experience? I understand that he was going after her in terms of fundraising, but were there cases he made about his own experience or about, you know, how she has spent her time?
Regarding his own experience, you know, he said not to discount his experience in local government working with people. He brought up many stories of his time working in as health department leadership in a health department leadership capacity, you know, working with folks who couldn't afford their medical bills or who were going into incredible amounts of debt because of their medical bills, dealing with cancer, dealing with family members' cancer, et cetera. So that was one. And afterward, he said he wished he had more chances to talk about his own policy proposals and goals, especially around the healthcare space, like Medicare for All, for example. In terms of criticizing Stevens, you know, he had she had brought up a bill earlier on, or that she had supported earlier on dealing with AI, and he criticized it as, I think his words were giveaway or something to that effect to AI companies. You know, Stevens fought back and pushed back against that, saying that wasn't the case and mentioned some things she felt in that bill were very important. So in terms of her actual voting record in Congress, I think that it was a little bit, a lot of these policies that the policy discussion itself didn't come up to the same extent that questions about where the money in politics was coming from and where the influence could be seen.
There have been moments earlier this year when Abdul Al-Sayed has said that he wanted to abolish immigration and customs enforcement, calling them a paramilitary force in our streets. He took some shots about that. I mean, I guess it's hard to know if the Senate will have a chance to do that, if that's something that will come up in policy. Was he voicing any alternative proposals for immigration last night?
So Al-Sayed again brought up his desire to abolish ICE. You know, again, he said, quote, ICE is about normalizing paramilitary force on our street. And again, you know, he was saying that it's not just a threat to, you know, American citizens, but basically he was saying that he was trying to draw this tie to ICE's presence on American streets being a threat to the Constitution itself. And so he was saying some of the alternatives are, you know, investing in court infrastructure, for example, or just finding other ways outside of ICE, this relatively new agency created within the last 30 years or so, to work on this immigration enforcement to make sure that everyone in the system gets due process, but also to make sure that people are being treated in a humane way.
Haley Stevens referred to the billions of dollars that ICE received in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act as a slush fund. Let's listen to a little bit more.
Donald Trump's ICE is completely out of control, and it is an abuse of power. ICE agents from top to bottom that have committed crimes have to be held accountable, and I've got the legislation to do it. I called on Kristi Noem to go. She was removed, but no reforms took place. They took $70 billion of our taxpayer money into an ICE slush fund. This has been a failure.
Again, that's candidate Haley Stevens in her debate with Abdul Al-Sayed last night. Colin, would you say that the candidates sounded very different in their approach?
In terms of their approach to ICE, I'm not so sure. That's one thing that kind of stuck with me when it came to policy questions. I don't think there was a lot of disagreement there. You know, on issues like ICE, for example, you could say wanting to abolish ICE versus reform ICE. That is a major difference there. But both agree at the end of the day that ICE as it currently stands is not serving the American public to its best ability. When it came to issues like making childcare more affordable, you know, that was probably the wonkiest answer, to be honest with you. I heard, you know, Stevens talk a lot about expanding community block development grants. You know, Al-Sayed said he wanted to make childcare free and use, and a lot of his answers came down to taxing billionaire wealth to pay for some of these other priorities, some of these social safety net priorities.
Colin, in some people's minds, a key issue in this race is how the Senate might serve as a check on the Trump administration's foreign policy, especially in the Middle East with respect to Gaza, Lebanon, and other military engagements that Israel has taken the lead on, but the U.S. has been in some ways an ally to. At what point did that issue come up in the debate?
I would say that came up very early on. You know, the second question was asked, what should the U.S. policy towards Iran be? You know, in the very first question, just about making life more affordable, Al-Sayed brought up AIPAC and corporate donations and corporate money. And so this was a fight that started very early on. It's no secret that AIPAC has supported Stevens' campaign this time around and in past campaigns. And so Al-Sayed really tried to paint Stevens as a candidate who would listen to their influence when it came to bringing the U.S. into wars, in, like, for example, in Gaza or in Iran. Stevens, for her part, you know, vehemently fought back against that. You know, she said that Netanyahu was not interested in peace, that the goal for the Middle East should be peace right now. She said she believed in a two-state solution. She argued that the Israeli government right now is not doing those things, you know, and she was very critical of that during her, from her time on stage. El-Sayed was skeptical, you know, and he said that the foreign policy in terms of this aspect, you know, what the United States is doing in support of Israel and other governments that he says are committing atrocities abroad is coming back to what's not available, is taking resources away from people here in Michigan. And so you saw him, at least on his side, really try to tie a lot of questions about affordability, about livability, about increasing, improving life here in Michigan to this idea that where the government should be responsibly spending their money.
Colin Jackson reports for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Colin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
On the campaign trail, Abdul El-Sayed has talked a lot about his prior work in public health. One claim, $700 million in medical debt in Wayne County has been erased. But is it true? As part of our ongoing Fact Squad series, Michigan Public's Zoe Clark spoke with Bridge Michigan's Lauren Gibbons.
Lauren, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Lauren, there's this new minute-long ad, and in it, there's a clip that says El-Sayed got rid of millions of dollars of medical debt. And then in big letters, it says $700 million in medical debt erased. So what did you find?
So the Wayne County Health Department did get rid of millions of dollars of medical debt. That is true. The $700 million was the ultimate goal, but that hasn't quite happened yet. The program has paid off so far about $57.4 million in medical debt for about 83,000 residents, according to Wayne County records. And so the program has started, and their nonprofit that the county's working with, Undue Medical Debt, expects to announce additional investments in the coming months. But it says it'll likely take more time for the county to ultimately hit that $700 million goal.
Mm-hmm. Even at this smaller number, he's called the relief, quote, the biggest medical debt erasure in Michigan state history. Do we know if that's correct?
It's definitely the biggest by a local government, by a county. Since the Wayne County program was announced, the state has also invested millions of dollars into erasing medical debt for residents around the state. And so that program has since erased about $200 million. So technically, at this point, that is most likely the biggest medical debt erasure. That said, Wayne County does have a pretty robust program. Kalamazoo and Oakland have also done local partnerships, but those contracts are set to expire by the end of the year.
What still needs to happen? Like, what would it take to erase this goal of $700 million in medical debt?
I think the main thing is to get all of the major Wayne County health providers on board and willing to negotiate with the nonprofit settling some of these debts. At this stage, that hasn't happened yet. Two of the three major hospitals in Detroit, for example, still haven't participated in the program. And the other thing is Wayne County commissioners also have to decide the program's future, whether they're planning on continuing to invest in it, renegotiate the contract. And so there's a lot of unknowns at this stage. It's also important to note that medical debt hasn't stopped accruing. People are still going to the hospital, right. Still may not be able to pay. So that $700 million number was the amount that they were hoping to erase in 2024. It's unclear whether there's been more since.
Lauren, we mentioned at the beginning that El-Sayed spends a lot of time on the campaign trail and in this new ad talking about his previous work in public health. What else should we know?
Yeah, he's also talked a lot about the program that he worked on both in Detroit and Wayne County to get kids free glasses. And he has estimated about 16,000 free glasses have been distributed since those programs started. And that's pretty accurate from what I can tell. He's also focused a lot on some of his efforts to distribute Narcan, which is a anti-overdose medication throughout the county. Those free dispensers for Narcan are continuing since he resigned to pursue the U.S. Senate. He's also worked on lead abatement efforts in the city of Detroit and air quality issues, and we'll probably hear more about that on the campaign trail.
That is Lauren Gibbons with our Fact Squad series. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Michigan Public's Zoe Clark talking with Lauren Gibbons from Bridge, Michigan. That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us. We'll see you next time.